Anyway, please bid me help me bid welcome to my friend Clancy I from up in the sky.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I don't want to criticize. I don't want to make any comments derogatorily towards the administration of this affair tonight. When a fella comes 400 miles and is asked to stand at the end of 500 people in a line and can't cut in... That's the AA way, but I hate it. I knew that when I got to the head of the line and got to the turkey, at least I'd identify. I want to especially thank Bill. He's been very gracious today. I brought my son with me. My son... was a sophomore in high school. He so staggered me by getting good grades this semester, I took him along to... And so we came up here today, and I showed him San Francisco, places where, when I was his age, I'd already gone bad. And I warned him against it. I guess I made it sound like fun. He wanted to stay. And we rode a cable, did all the tourist things, and then we... rode the Sausalito ferry back from Sausalito back to the ferry building, and it was very nice, and I want to thank him very much. He's been very gracious. At one time this afternoon, he was actually so friendly, at one time he started to reach for the check once, but he pulled his hand back in the nick of time so he wouldn't spoil his record. I want to mention something. About 21 years ago, I was sober about 12 months or 14 months at Christmas time, and I had just got about 3 months before that moved in inside. I'd been living in the back seat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot for many months. I didn't have any front teeth, and I weighed about 125 pounds, and I used to lurk around something called the 6300 Club, which was the AA Club, and a group in West Covina, which is east of Los Angeles, called up on Christmas Eve and said their speaker had canceled out. They couldn't get any speaker willing to come out on Christmas Eve. And could the AA Club send somebody? They canvassed everybody in the club. Nobody's going to go out there on Christmas Eve. And they got so desperate, the guy said to me, he says, do you want to talk? Do that. So I hustled some transportation out to West Covina, and I felt terrible. I'd lost my family. They were in Dallas, my children. My parents were up in Wisconsin. I'd come from a family-oriented Christmas, and this was Christmas. I was living alone in a little room, didn't even have a Christmas tree, just alone and forgotten. Never be anything again. So I went out there, and I gave them a talk. I told them how crappy Christmas was, and sick and tired of hearing about it in AA. And if one other guy said Merry Christmas to me, I was going to kick him. And I talked about how Christmas had used to seem, when I was a little boy, I used to go to my grandmother's, my dad would pull me on my sled, and my Aunt Alma would come down from Minneapolis, and my Uncle Vern, and I always wanted to get a pony when I was a little boy, and sometimes I'd get a sled, or I never got the pony, got a train, other things, and I grew up, and everything went to hell, and I didn't even dare think about Christmas, because it was so bad, I got done with that hour-long talk. There were only about 15 people there lurking in the basement of an American Legion hall. And they must have been neurotics as I was, because they said, come back next year and talk. Tell us again. Would one of my children like to get me some sweet and low, please? That's you, Spud. That's why I carry him along with me. They can't get up. I got their ticket in my pocket. He can't get up. I went out there the next year, and they had about 30 people. They couldn't... I guess they talked it up. You won't believe this, son of a bitch. You know? Well, it went on like that. Last Christmas, A month ago, I talked there for the 21st consecutive year. And now it's an enormous meeting. Every neurotic for miles around comes barreling in for the anti-Christmas talk. And I almost generally talk about the same way. I start off by saying, when I was a... What am I supposed to stir it with these? That's a big meeting. There were about 600 people there in an enormous hall, and thank you very much. Do you have any black ink? They call me a prima donna. I don't know why they say that. Anyway, and I was talking about how I used to be a little boy, and I used to go to my grandfather's on my sled, and my dad would pull me, and I was, you know, wait for Aunt Alma and Uncle Vern to come down on the train, and hope I'd get a pony, and I got a train or a sled, and then I grew up, and everything went to hell. And right in the middle of this, a guy jumped up in the front row in this enormous hall, three times as big as this, maybe. He's like, I can't stand it! I can't stand it! And he rushed out the door. Now, I've been, you know, and the worst part of it is, I'm his sponsor. And he's been sober over 20 years, and he's been at that meeting every year. And he said, I can't stand it. And he rushed out, and I didn't know what the hell happened. Well, I guess he snapped. The pressure was too great for him. So I tried to pick up the thread of my talk, and in about 3 minutes, he walked back in leading a pony. I was flabbergasted. He brought it up to the podium. He says, I've been hearing that crap about your pony for 20 years. Here's your goddamn pony. I haven't been speechless often, but I was right then. And he was a baleful-looking little Shetland pony with long yellow teeth. Yeah. Then they finally let him out. We returned to the meeting. It was dreadful. And I got thinking later in my talk, that was kind of a cute gag to rent a pony and come down. You know, I thought it was kind of dumb, but it's... Well... And then at the end of the meeting, in the secretary's closing announcements, he thanked about a list of 10 names, members of the group who had chipped in to buy the pony for Clancy. So the next day, a truck backed up to my house, and this hideous pony got out. And he's been living in my backyard ever since. We built him a little stable. This morning before I came up here, Daddy was out in the stable with his shovel. And the reason I mention that is because I think it was touching of them to do it. Now, I've been up to Pleasanton a couple times. You know, when I was a kid, I always wanted a Mercedes-Benz. Worth a try. But I am glad to be here. I've been in this city twice before. Once when I spoke here 3 or 4 years ago. Once when I got discharged from the Navy here many, many years ago from Camp Shoemaker at the end of the war. And I was not doing well then, and I didn't do well thereafter. And I drank for a number of years, like most of you did. In looking back over my life, I think it's safe to say that alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. It sounds terrible because, you know, speakers are supposed to get up the podium and denounce alcohol. Terrible. But I'll tell you, alcohol, if it's working for you, is the best friend you'll ever have. I think it's safe to say, your best friend that you have tonight, the chances are better than 50%, I'd imagine, that 2 years from now, you'll have a different best friend. Not because you anything critical, but people move and their attitudes change and their likes and dislikes change. Some of you young guys here tonight who are going through an era of your life where you think your happiness depends upon her smile, you know. You may be surprised to learn that in a couple years you may not be able to remember her name. You know. And vice versa. Jobs come and go, and cities come and go, and states come and go. But by God, a drink is always good. I come from a little town up in northern Wisconsin, as I've mentioned many times. I was raised in the Lutheran religion. You can always spot Lutherans. They're the only ones with enough class to wear a tie. No, don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed. You and I will go to the well-dressed section of heaven. The Catholics are over there in their sports shirts playing bingo. And scratching themselves. And when I was a boy, I had a great lust for adventure in life. And early in the Second World War, I wanted to know what was going on. I lived in this little town. I felt I was being held back. And I didn't have a pleasant home life because my parents had been divorced when I was 11 or 12. And I'd never seen a divorce. I'd never heard of a divorce at that time. And there was step-parents. And I wanted to get moving. So one weekend, I told my mother I was going to go up to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt. And instead, I just hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea how far it was. I looked on the map in the school library, and it looked like about four. There was a blue state, a yellow state, and I'd never seen a blue state. I wanted to see that. I was really dumb. I hadn't even been to Milwaukee yet, you know, and here I am. And thank God I got one ride most of the way, or I never would have made it, because I just had no idea the immensity of the country. And this last guy that I rode with about 1,000 miles, he told me, he said, I was small and skinny and had a face full of pimples ready to go at any moment. Just terrible. And he said, I don't think you're going to get in the Navy or the Marine Corps like you hope to kill Japs. I don't think you're going to pass for... He said, why don't you go to the Coast Guard? They're crying for merchant seamen and they don't have much requirements. So he dropped me off and I, on the Oakland Mole, and bought me a ticket on the ferry. And I remember I was telling my son about that today. I don't believe, there'll always be a golden memory. I'd never seen anything like it. The ferry set off at 6 o'clock in the morning through the fog, and as the fog dissipated, I saw these big hills and these buildings. It looked like Oz. It just couldn't, And he told me where to go to the Coast Guard office on Market Street. And I slept up there, and I went in, and I said, I'd like to be a merchant seaman. I guess they were crying for merchant seaman, and he gave me an application, and I filled it out. They said, you'll have to have your parents sign this. So I took it around the block and had my parents sign it. They said, you have proof you're 16? I was 15, but I said, no, but I am. He said, okay. And they issued me some seamen's papers, if you can believe that, temporary. And he referred me to the National Maritime Union, and I schlepped down there. And, and they had me sign a waiver saying they could take the union dues out of my first pay. And they just had openings on the board, and he assigned me to a pier across from the Embarcadero YMCA, and I schlepped over there. And that night I was on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. And it was a great thrill going underneath that Golden Gate Bridge. I was thinking about that driving over it today. But I suddenly noticed the earth was going out of sight. That was about all I wanted of that. So I sidled up to the captain, told him I really appreciated this opportunity, but I really should get back now because we had a big English test Monday and I didn't want to miss that. He wished me well, I guess. He told me to luck off. And he said I should get to my forecastle. I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it was through a door and it sounded ominous. All the clothes I had in the world were on me. And I went in there and it turns out, most of you know, forecastle is just a sleeping area on a ship. And I was stuck in there with three of the worst. I walked in this room and I saw immediately three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, pimply-faced, insecure kid can ever be with. And these kind of people are called
men.
And they just looked at me funny.
What are you supposed to be?
And I saw there was a lot of tension. I tried to ease it by telling some jokes that I heard in study hall, and they just...
Why don't you shut your damn mouth and get in your bunk?
I just felt hopeless and helpless. And as I was lying there, and I was starting to get seasick, and that ship was moving, and I wanted my mother. That's what I... But I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. And these guys start talking. They got to start talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco while the ship had been in port. And I was just staggered. I had never heard talk like that. I couldn't believe my ears. I thought, I'm in a room with sinners. Yeah. And they talked about these things they'd been doing with these women, and I just wanted to cringe. I just wanted to cry. I just couldn't believe it. I don't want to leave the wrong impression. Even at the age of that age, I'd had sex, but I'd been apprehensive and I'd been anxious and I'd been alone. And I didn't know this two at a time stuff was going on. I really didn't. And one of these guys went to his sea bag and he reached into his sea bag and took out a bottle of whiskey. I'd never been in a room with a bottle of whiskey at that age. He said to one of his friends, "You want a little snort?"
"Yeah." "You want a little snort?" "Yeah."
And he turned to me and he had a very unpleasant look on his face. I was not very sophisticated. I couldn't grade it down beyond unpleasant. Today I suppose I'd call it patronizing or supercilious or something. But then it was just unpleasant.
"How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?"
And I looked up, and whenever the heat is on, I have a tendency to choke. I just... But I could just feel my pimples stand up. And my face got red. I didn't say anything, but I thought at him. I thought, "You big dummy. I guess you've never seen a Lutheran, have you?" Lutherans don't drink whiskey. Even if they did, I promised both my mother and grandmother I would never drink. And even if I hadn't promised them I wouldn't drink, I won't drink. Because whatever knowledge I had of the world, I got by going to the movies and reading Life magazine. That's all I ever did. And good guys in those days didn't ever drink. Bad guys drank. Errol Flynn never took a drink in his life, to the best of my knowledge. Yeah. Not in Sherwood Forest, he didn't. There's a whole bunch of bad guys. Guys like Basil Rathbone and Claude Rains and Buck Jones never took a drink that I ever heard of. All was some rustler named Slade.
Yeah, I know. Let's go kill Buck Jones's horse. Ha, ha, yeah.
And there's no way that I'm going to drink. And that big guy stuck that bottle in my face and said, "You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And I didn't say anything, but I magically heard my own voice say, "Goddamn right." So I always have a tendency to crumble under pressure, too. And that day I had my first drink of whiskey. And it burned my mouth, and it burned my throat, and it burned my stomach, and it burned my stomach, and burned my throat, and burned my mouth, and burned his shirt the last I saw her. And what I remember most about that is not the fact I got sick and threw up, but the scornful laughter. God, I can still hear it. And there's nothing I could do. I had no tools to deal with them. See, like the story of my life. Sometime later, I thought there was one thing I could have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They would have killed me. But what I might have done, I might have said to that guy, I said, "Hey, buddy, lean over."
"Yeah."
"Take that." Just give him a zip in the old eye. And all the way across the Central Pacific, every day I would sneak into this guy's sea bag when nobody was around and take a drink of that slop. And I hated it and I detested it. But your mind has a tendency to justify and rationalize, I guess. And it wants to lay off responsibility or heat or pressure. And it just seemed to me that because I had thrown up that whiskey, they were treating me like a dumb, stupid little punk. It never struck me that the reason they treated me like a dumb, stupid little punk was because I was a dumb, stupid little punk. That didn't strike me. So I thought if I could ever drink, I would look like a man to them. I remember a day out of Pearl Harbor, I took another drink. I'd been throwing them up all the way across the ocean. And it burned my mouth and burned my throat and hit my stomach and stayed there. And I thought, now if I can just do this, not make a face. And it turned out, I had no idea of it then or for many years thereafter, it turned out that I had a body that was responsive to alcohol. I had no idea of it. It just, something happened to change my feelings somehow. And I didn't know what it was, but I just accepted it as one of the things you accept when you grow up. You occasionally find good things. You know, I have, because perhaps of my early religious training and then when I was older, my later cynicism and my own revulsion towards religion, because if religion were true or spirituality was true, I was doomed, so it's easier not to believe in it. I was never one in my years of my life to give much, when I got older, to give much credence to all the little mystical, celestial nuances that people like to talk about. Even after I was in AA, it just dragged me to hear, you know, people say things like, "Well, I was sitting in that bar car and I heard a voice say, 'Go back to your Pullman.' So I did. And a few miles later, that bar car derailed and many people were killed. And I knew God didn't want me to drink. He was teaching me a lesson." I think, what's God teaching those poor bastards in the bar car, you know? That seems like kind of an expensive lesson. Or I'd hear people say things like, "I was 3 months behind in my rent, and I went to A&A, and I went to an old-timer, and I said, 'What do I do?' And he said, 'Turn it over, son.' And I did. And the next day, a check came in the mail from an old insurance policy. And I knew the program worked." I tried that once in Dallas and got evicted, goddamn it. It just seems like every time I got around AA, there was always some old lady with some miraculous thing that happened that just infuriated me. Well, it just happened, I don't know, meant to be. Yeah. So I'm not against it, but I was not for it. Because it seemed to me God was hideously selective in who he did things for. He'd the same old crap heads he has done. And over a period of time in AA, we were talking about that today in the car as we were driving around. I have One of the first impressive things I came to believe in a higher power when I was sober a while, and then I came to believe in AA, and I came to believe in my sponsor, and so on. But I'll tell you, there's something in AA that I believe must truly be inspired by a power greater than us. There is something for which I can find no rational or logical explanation. And it's this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. This book must be inspired because it gets smarter every year. Every year. It really does. It really doesn't even get smart till you're sober a while. And then it gets smarter every year. And the thing that's impressive about it is that the man who wrote it didn't have enough knowledge to write that important stuff that well. You know, they always say, well, the first 100 men, women who stayed sober a year sat around with Bill Wilson and they wrote that book. That's not true. The guy who wrote this book, when he wrote it, there weren't 100 men and women sober a year. There'd been 100 men and women sober a year now, in toto. In the first 4 years, 100 people made a year, but many of them were drunk again already. There weren't 100 men and women sober a year at any one time. So he not only had no background, but he was watching most of the people failing. And he had no background in psychology. He knew nothing about alcoholism. You know, anybody here sober a year knows more about alcoholism than he knew then, because there was no knowledge to be gained at that time. He had no background in spiritual things whatsoever. He was not a religious man. And he wrote this by watching people. Some survived and some didn't, and then vice versa. And he wrote things in there that I am just learning now after 20 years of sobriety. And he wrote these down, and he was sober 4 years, and most of that tenuously. Now, if you're new, being sober 4 years may think that makes you quite wise. But when you get to be sober 4 years, you realize you're not quite as wise as you thought you would be. By the time you're sober 5 years, people 4 years sober, you just kind of smile at. Glad you're still making it. By the time you're 10 years sober, people 4 years sober, you send for coffee if they can remember to put in one sweet and low and cream. By the time you're 20 years sober, you don't want people 4 years sober in your home unattended. Yeah. Nothing personal, that's just the way it is. You know, we don't judge here, we just report. But this guy, 4 years sober, wrote stuff that, I'll tell you, when I came to AA, I was a successful writer, and I thought this was a dumb book. As the years have gone by year, I've had experiences and insights and knowledges that have just made that book come true. A few years ago, I had to record this for some blind people. And that's a difficult thing because you can't skim when you do that. You know, you can read the book. I can read this whole book in an hour and a half if I'm allowed to skim. Just read the funny parts. Get to the stories. But when you have to tape it, you have to read it slowly. And I remember how staggered I was. Jesus, I read stuff in that book when I was taping it that I never remembered reading before. It really is a remarkable piece of practical, realistic, logical stuff that until you're sober a while, it just seems like some more do-gooderism stuff. It really doesn't make sense till you've been sober a few years. And then it gets smarter and smarter. I've got to believe that that is truly the most remarkable book I have ever read. One of the lines in there that meant nothing to me when I was new, but has come to mean something to me over the years because I understand what it means now. He was watching people come to AA. Now, you get the impression sometimes that AA was founded by a bunch of down-and-outers on the street corner somewhere. It wasn't that. AA was not even founded. It was a little group within another group called the Oxford Movement. Now, the Oxford Movement was also known as the Moral Rearmament Program, also known as the Buckmanites. It was a little group kind of similar to TA today, or TM, or something like that, of guys who were and women who were in trouble, but they weren't down and outers. They were people who'd had some success in the world, but had some troubles of different kinds, and they went this for some kind of a program, as people go to TA or TM or Esther anywhere else. And most of the people who were there for a drinking problem, the author of this saw, were people who had apparently grown up, become somewhat successful, drunk for a number of years, and then somehow or other, alcohol began to have a different effect on them that they couldn't identify or understand, and things started to go to hell. And he tried to identify this, and he put a little sentence in there. It's a throwaway line, but it really describes it perfectly. He said, "We seem to be people who have crossed an invisible line." What's the invisible line? When alcohol begins to have a special effect on you. But you don't know when you crossed it, you don't know how you crossed it, you don't know why you crossed it, and you don't know you've crossed it until way after you've crossed it, usually. And this invisible line merely is alcohol begins to have a special effect. Now, of course, when he wrote this book in the late 1930s, based on the people he was seeing, the general impression was that if you drank for a number of years, you eventually drank your way across that invisible line. Because that's the way most of the people were then. But since then, of course, in additional literature in AA and in our own experience, we have seen hundreds of thousands of people come to AA who only drank a few years, apparently, before they crossed that invisible line. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of us who seem to cross that invisible line the first time alcohol got in their body. It just did something different. In fact, that crossing the line is what makes a lot of, sometimes a little misunderstandings in AA. Sometimes you'll see a guy at a podium, he'll say things like, I drank for 45 years. And he looks accusingly at some young punk about 22 years old in the front row. I drank for 45 years. I spilled more than some of you ever drank. And the kid is sitting there 22 years old looking up at this old fool and saying, you ain't much of an alcoholic if you lasted 40 years, you old sumbitch, you know. And it turns out it doesn't make much difference how long you drank. It's how long it took to cross that invisible line, because that's when the fun starts. In Chapter 5, read by our charming birthday girl tonight, there's a funny line that always makes me laugh. There's something in the effect of our adventures before and after. You know, just no more adventures if you don't mind. It makes it sound such a positive thing. Yes, we had some adventures. They're down there. Then I haven't seen a crowd like this since the adventure we had when we oversold the Christmas pageant, the Texas Nut House in Big Spring, Texas. You hear rumbles in the back. It's like, you better give us a goddamn seat. Made the pageant move rather rapidly, I'll tell you. I was the director of that pageant, folks. Because they saw in my record that I had directed an opera at the University of Texas the spring before that, so the following winter, when I was directing this, when I was in the Nut House, they had me direct the Christmas pageant, which was not quite like an opera. It was just quite simple, so the whole student body could follow along. The director's main job was just trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary till we get the curtain on the wheel. But the interesting concept, that was to me anyway, the concept of alcohol begins to do something special in your body. And you wonder what the hell it is that it does special in your body. What does it do?
Does it make you drunk all the time? Not really.
Does it make you terribly drunk?
Not really.
In fact, we just came through this, on the first day of this month, we just came through one of the worst days of all year, the night before which the amateurs are out getting drunk. The non-alcoholics, the people who don't know how to be drunks. There's no worse time to be on the streets than New Year's Eve when those simpletons, they don't know how to get drunk. They don't know how to do anything. They're just anybody here in this room has got at least 15 seconds to know when you're going to throw up. Christ, you just recognize the symptoms. You say things like, pardon me.
Anybody got a cert?
These social drinkers, they don't recognize the symptoms at all. You can be talking to them and they say things like,
well, I was saying to Fred, I said, bleh!
They're just hideous, just hideous. Anybody here, when you start to feel the world tilt, you just automatically go. They just fall down. They don't know. They don't know enough to put one hand over an eye and drive. They bump into parked cars. Getting drunk doesn't make you an alcoholic. In fact, it's almost... Non-alcoholics are the world's worst drunks when they get drunk. They're just sickening. They truly are. Admit it deep in yourself, you know. That isn't what makes an alcoholic. What the hell does alcohol do to you? Make you do strange things? Not really. Alcohol doesn't make you do... It may remove some of your inhibitions so you can do the things you've been thinking about. It takes a long time to come to understand, I think, the special effect alcohol has on an alcoholic. And I never knew an alcoholic that knew it, and I never knew it. And I never knew a drinking alcoholic that ever knew it, and I never knew a lot of guys that ain't knew it. But it would appear that the special effect that alcohol has on an alcoholic isn't what it does to him or her at all. It's something much more subliminal and complex and difficult to ascertain. It's what it does for you that makes you an alcoholic. It has a special effect that does something for you. And you don't even know it's doing anything for you because you have nothing to compare it against. I spent most of my life thinking alcohol did that same thing for everybody. And if they didn't drink, it meant they didn't have the problems I had or the emotions or they were square or religious or something. To me, alcohol was just a natural force that I thought happened to everybody, and some people needed it worse because they were more emotional. And that's why later in the war, I went in the Navy. I used alcohol from then on. I don't mean that I became a raving drunk. It was just like using a new something that I found about growing up, like sex or anything else. It's pleasurable, but there's tabs that come and try to learn to use it. And I went in the Navy, and at the end of the war, I got out of Camp Shoemaker over here. They're sewing my stomach back together again. At the end of the war, they passed out a bunch of all the unused examinations they had left at the Red Cross office. And I've always been great on examinations. I'm still a sophomore or a junior in Eau Claire, Wisconsin High School. I still am today. And I cracked this test, and they gave me a high school equivalency, and I used that. And I went to college after the war. I went back to Eau Claire first, and I stood around street corners with other veterans trying to look Like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. And that got tiresome, so we went to college. Because they were paid $75 a month. And I went to college. I got married in college. I did something that my family was very shocked at. They really... It's hard to remember that in this century, 30 or 40 years ago, there was still a lot of real religious bigotry, and especially in the Midwest. And one thing my parents always asked, my grandmother used to say, don't ever marry a Catholic. Don't ever marry a Catholic. But I met this Catholic girl. This was a new, brave new world, and after the war, and I married that Catholic girl. She was young and pretty and lovely, and my family was just shocked. Some of them wouldn't come to the wedding. And I was just appalled at them, but it turned out they were right. I don't mean that she was a bad girl, and in any way, she's a lovely girl, but one thing Catholics never tell Lutherans, that if you marry a Catholic girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family. Ready or not. And I used to just plead to her. I said, this is the brave new world. Put aside these archaic beliefs. Can't we use birth control? All the veterans do. No. I said, could I get something for the prevention of disease? They sell them down here in the washroom door. No. She had a priest come over one afternoon. They gave me a 2.5-hour talk on the rhythm system, which was their version of birth control. And I listened intently, but I couldn't pick up the beat. I just... I became a national distributor of small Catholics. So I had to get a job quick, so I didn't go to... At the end of my senior year of college, I missed a final in English history, so I had to take it at summer school. And in summer school, I was drinking so bad, thinking about the indignity of it, I finally got expelled from the university just before my graduation. But that didn't make any difference. I had to work anyway, and I went out and became a sports writer. Then as more children came, I got a job in advertising and public relations. And on and on, and I just was like a fox in a forest fire all the time. It's just, not because of that, but everything. It seemed the characteristic emotion of my life has been, mostly up until the last few years, just a continuing, gnawing sense of unease. Just, this is not quite it. Occasional euphoria, but back to the unease. And I wanted to be successful. I had such a tremendous desire for success. It took me some time in AA to realize. Anyone with that much desire for success, it usually indicates they don't have much inside, so they got to get more and more outside to compensate for it. And I did a lot of things. I got into psychoanalysis. You know, a lot of people in AA put down psychoanalysis. I was in psychoanalysis almost 30 years ago. It was much better then. Today, it's become so common. Everybody been to psychoanalysis. But in my day, you had to be a sensitive thinker. And a lot of people put it down. I loved it. It was in psychoanalysis I discovered that... I had been hurt by forces beyond my control. Things weren't really my fault. I found out, I didn't even know there'd been a depression, and I found out, till I found out I'd been warped by it. I really got to know a great deal about my problems. God, I just loved it. And the trouble with psychoanalysis, you get to know so much about this, the things that are underneath your consciousness, that it completely blinds you to the fact you're not getting any better. It's like being on the deck of the Titanic and hitting an iceberg for me, and everybody else rows away, and people like me say, no, I'm not getting off this ship till I discover exactly what happened. And you may wind up with the answer, you say. I've got the answer. It takes a while to realize it doesn't do any good to have the answer if you got no way to get off the sinking ship. Answers aren't worth anything by themselves. I got into metaphysics another time. Again, that's become terribly plebeian. You know, in my day, you had to be a seeker, one of the few who understood. And I was having some bad times. I was working morning, or I was working days in an advertising agency. At night, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas directing this opera. I was writing a weekly sports thing for the El Paso Times. My wife was pregnant still again. I was under a lot of pressure. And I just drink to take the heat off a little bit. And one of the ways you know you're having trouble with drinking is when you start running into people who start talking to you for your own good. God, it's just... And they say different things, but they all have one thing in common. They all have little thin blue lips. And some of them say things like, "Would you think your family would be proud to see you in this condition?" And some of them say things like, "How do you expect to stay part of the corporate team if you're going to act so bizarrely?" Or the one that everybody's heard, "But you have such potential." When you start hearing that, folks, start getting your papers together because you're going to be moving soon. And the dean of that university called me in. He told me I'd been acting bizarrely in Juarez and I had to stop drinking. So I stopped drinking because drinking wasn't my problem. But when I stop drinking, I have a tendency to get irritable and nervous. And I got into metaphysics and I gave it all I had. And in about 3 months, I became, to the best of my knowledge, one of six people in the whole state of Texas who knew truth. And the other five were just hopeless crapheads. Just nothing. And it gets very cold and lonely at the top, I'll tell you. It was a relief when I got to that nut house there. It just took the heat off. I read philosophy. I did a lot of things that imitation intellectuals do. But I look over my life, nothing has ever been quite as effective for me on a continuing basis as a few drinks. And I never even thought about it. But a few drinks seem to ease off things. It works better than any therapy I have ever heard of. It may be short term, but it works. The only problem is, sometimes I've been subjected to such pressures by people who didn't understand me that I have a tendency to be forced to drink more than I intended. And I have been known to get drunky poo in my day. And then they get on you like a bunch of crazed dogs. And then sometimes when I drink too much and brood and think, occasionally, things have happened that have interrupted my career. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in a suburb of Chicago. One spring. By the end of that same year, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. I shouldn't really say whorehouse. It was a place called the Crest Lounge. But it was a Crest Hotel and the Crest Lounge, and the same girls were there every night, and different guys, and they met, and they'd go upstairs to talk, and only the girls ever came back down. I don't know where the men went. They must have a pile of them up there somewhere. And I played and was wonderful. But I always reformed, because that's one of the curses of being born a Lutheran. If you're not good enough to stay good, you're out of luck, because you can't enjoy evil very long either. An old guy in Los Angeles says sometimes, he says, "Remember, when one door closes, another door opens." And I went up to him, I said, "Jesus, how about the rest? How about us who spend our lives in the hall? You know, we..."
I hear doors opening and closing, but I can't get there in time. I reformed another spring. I was in Texas. That winter, I was in the Texas Nut House. Got out of that Texas Nut House. I wasn't in there as an alcoholic. I hadn't sunk to that. I was in there as a suicide. That's what happens when I stay sober too long and no proof. Another spring, I was in Dallas working at the largest advertising agency in the South, a firm called Tracy Locke, working on these old ads. If you're old, you remember these Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company? Later that same year, I woke up one morning in the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, 1,000 miles away, and a guy had just got done kicking my front teeth out because I had vomited on his bunk. That was one of the few mornings I was ever really glad that I'd been in psychotherapy, because once you've been in psychotherapy, you always have an additional insight that most people don't have. And I was too sick to move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe, but I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember lying there and thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything and threaten our new friendship. And by that time, my wife had finally given up. She'd taken the advice she'd been getting for years to get away from that crazy bastard. And she moved into a post office box in Dallas with all these little kids. And seemed kind of cramped, but to hell with them. And I was going to try to get to Seattle, and I got as far as Los Angeles, and I lost my clothes, and I had my front teeth kicked out, and I went to the AA club there, because I'd been going to AA off and on for 9 years. Because people who don't understand your feelings think your problem is drinking. You ought to stop drinking. And if you do stop drinking, go to meetings, and old ladies come up and say, "We hate to see you fight God, sonny." I have a terrible temptation at such moments to say, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." But I went to that lousy old AA club and I hung around there for a while. And one night, in a moment of desperation, I couldn't get a job. In a moment, I got caught stealing the coffee money. I was just going to borrow it, pay it back, I hoped. But I got caught and I got banned out of the AA club, sober. I went out to the beach and some crazy old fool out there had started something called the Tender Loving Care Club. And he was a renegade AA. He thought AA was all right, but it wasn't too much spirituality. And I went for that. And he had set up this Tender Loving Care Club and he became the higher power, which... He called it AA, but he was the higher power. And I wasn't really an alcoholic, but I lurked out there for a while. And AA finally sent him a letter. You know, AA is always sending letters about their rotten old traditions. And they said, "You know, you can't call that AA out there because not all of AA accepts you as the higher power. There are some holdouts in Akron and, you know." And so he got mad and threw all the alcoholics out, one non-alcoholic out, took in a bunch of druggies. And I... Oops. I said, "What are you going to do with these druggies? You never took any drugs." "I'm going to get any letters from anybody, I'll tell you that." And he had this great plan. He's going to have them all turn over all their funds to him. And he wasn't going to give them back, and he's going to help them. And I thought, if anybody goes for that silly crap, I'll be surprised. But they did. He changed his name to Sinanon, made himself $1 million. And don't put it down, you know, because if I'd have stuck with Sinanon, I could have been something tonight. If I came here and there wasn't a chair for me, I'd have had the secretary kidnapped. Well... And then a few weeks later, I found myself on Skid Row. I was going to write a book about Skid Row to expose it. But I'd lost my pencil. And I found myself getting in fights in places like the Midnight Mission and being thrown out of the Midnight Mission. and being thrown out of the Union rescue mission. And couldn't sell blood anymore because I didn't have enough iron in my blood to sell blood in the Skid Row blood bank. I was beginning to think that things weren't going my way. And one morning I walked 71 blocks out to that lousy, stinking old AA club in Wilshire and Fairfax in the rain. The only reason I walked out there was because it was raining and I couldn't get out of the rain. I couldn't get to the missions. I thought, I'll pretend to be one of their sick little pukes. And I started to go in. The guy said, you can't come in. I said, oh, Tom, Jesus, I guess I had a little slip. He says, you didn't have a slip. You're a phony son of a bitch. I said, yeah, that's right, Tom. But I added his name to the list of people I'm going to kill someday. I said, Jesus, let me out of the rain. He says, go in the back room, but don't let anybody know I let you in. You're phony and you're sickening. Oh, that's right, Tom. I'm going to pull out your fingernails first. And I lay on the sofa in the back room, and I thought, I'm going to play their sick little stupid second-rate AA game. I've been in and out of AA meetings for years. And I knew that AA, it's nice. It's, you know, it's a nice thing. Turn it over. Do the right thing. Help others. Write your inventory. Hooray, hooray. That helps simpletons. That does not help thinkers. And I thought, I'll play their sick little game for a while until I can get a score and get to Seattle. And I played their sick little game too long. And they warped me. And now it's been something over 22 years since that morning. And I haven't had a drink of alcohol in my body. I haven't had any medications for my emotions. I wanted some, but nobody would give me any on spec. I have been able to avoid those members of the medical fraternity who still think my type of problem is caused by a Valium deficiency. I have not smoked any marijuana. It's funny in this day and age, even now, every once in a while you find a little pocket alongside the road of happy destiny with some weeds growing and some little pukes there saying,
book doesn't mention pot, baby.
But it mentions people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves, which is the next best thing. A few years ago when I was reading this book, I found out the book does mention pot, but a lot of people don't know it. And you might not have known it yourself if you hadn't been here tonight. Page 1, chapter 1, Bill's story. First paragraph deals with him as a young man drinking and too much in New England, and he went in the army. And it says, we landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by the inscription on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold, small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. I don't defend it, I just read it. That's the funny thing, I haven't had a chemical in my body stronger than an aspirin now since 1958, and I've come here tonight at tremendous expense. And no little, it wasn't expensive till I met Mason, but it's been expensive ever since. And no little inconvenience, because I want to talk to you newer people, especially, and ask you this most important question. Why can't you accept the program the way we did in the old days? Now, as you can tell, something happened to me along the way. I have front teeth. They say you shouldn't pick your teeth in public. That's how I got these. I said, I'll pick those, doctor. I don't weigh 108 pounds like I did when I got sober. I got a change of clothes. By the time I was, my first few months sober, I lived in this abandoned car. By the time I was Just almost a year sober, I finally made a score and moved out of the abandoned car. Got a little job. Got fired off four little jobs within a few days because I had a rotten attitude. I was a hope when I was sober a year, I had a job wrapping packages in an advertising agency, the same kind of job I'd had when I was a freshman in high school. That's what's called rocket to stardom. And by the time I was 2 years sober, I had a little job in a medical corporation as a beginning writer. I had sunk so low, I couldn't get a decent sponsor anymore. You know, a society, you want to get a sponsor who's got some society aspect. Somebody's got a little class, so you can say, he's my sponsor. Say, oh. And I'd had sponsors off and on for 9 years. I had sponsors in Chicago and Dallas and El Paso and Minneapolis and a lot of cities. And sponsors, a sponsor with love is a man who, when you call him up drunk, he says, oh, you're drunk. Don't move. I'll be right over. We'll get your problem settled. I'll be right there. Hang on. Hang on. And sometimes you can be drinking when he comes in just to punish him a little bit. And he gets tears in his eyes. Now, that's a sponsor with love. And I fell into the hands of some crazy old fool who'd say things like, listen, kid, if you want to talk to me, you call me before you drink. Because after you drink, all you're going to hear is a click and a dial tone. That's pretty severe, Bob. He'd say things to me like, you got to work today? I was going to, Bob. You know, I got to think about my kids I'll never see again. And I just get these terrible depressions. I just can't keep going. He said, I heard all that shit in your inventory. Go to work. It got to just easier to go to work than to listen to him. Just and you find out something funny. If you go to work every day, people don't know that your case is different. They think you're sincere. And by the time I was 5 years sober, hell, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. I was writing for medical journals. I thought I knew everything. By the time I was 7 years sober, I'd become hip and slick again. I was working in... they brought another guy and I into Hollywood, and we created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio, and we all wore shiny suits and said bitchin' a lot. Hey, bitchin', baby. Hoo, hoo. What's coming on down, baby? But you get sick of pimping to 13-year-olds after a while. By the time I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for oil companies. They need as badly then as they do now. Maybe not quite as badly. When I was 15 years sober, I was a marketing director for a publishing firm in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those daughters heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to a post office box in Dallas, Texas. Leaped out of their post office box with hideous cries, fled to my side, attached themselves to my wallet like a series of lamprey fish to a lake trout. Have bled me white ever since. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another little Catholic hit the street. Fortunately, I got a metronome. That little Catholic that almost didn't get born is sitting over there tonight. He is now the dreaded right guard for the horrible St. Monica's Catholic High School football team. And I got to keep remembering he's grown up now and he lifts weights and is strong because I have a tendency sometimes to say, Clancy, clean your room. Clean that up. It's a garbage can in there. Get in there. Turn off that television. Blah, blah, blah. I hate to let him know that I know this, but I know one of these days he's going to say,
Protestant dog.
But not today, kid. Not today. And I have my daughter, one of my married daughters, is here tonight with her husband, who's driven from Davis. I was surprised to see them. And she was a little girl who, when she was born, I was drunk. And she had a very bad blood condition. I went to the hospital in Dallas. And I said, let me give her my blood. And they said, no, we want her to have a chance. Move out. And this Christmas, everybody was home from all over, all his daughters and husbands and children and grandchildren and dogs and horses and parrots and Christ. I was wondering, where's that abandoned car? Just a couple of weeks. Now, isn't that a nice AA success story? Down and out, dying on the street, and now I'm just fine. There's only one thing that if you're kind of new or feeling cynical, you may leave one little doubt. How do you get from there to there? What is it in AA that makes some people, it works for some people and don't work for others? There isn't anybody in this room, I'm sure, who has ever had that feeling worse than me. Because I'll tell you, the most important thing I have said tonight, or I will say before I sit down in a few minutes, I said a long time ago, and nobody paid any attention to it. Nor should you, really. I said, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Because that is the single most difficult thing I ever had to believe. I could say it, but I couldn't believe it. Because my problem is not alcohol. It is sometimes. But unlike these boobs I hear in AA meetings, when I get sober, it doesn't get better. It gets better for a little while, and then reality creeps in again. And it all goes to hell. And I have spent much of my life wondering why that was. There's a little trap I have fallen into maybe 10,000 times in my life. I used to think I didn't even identify it for years. And I thought maybe I was the only one who did it. Then I came to believe that people like us do it. Then I got working in high-level corporate places, and I realized everybody does it. Sometimes. People like us do it a lot because it happens to you when you are going through areas of insecurity and feelings of inadequacy, which are among the hallmarks of our illness sometimes. And that little trap is when you're feeling inadequate or insecure or you're not sure how you're doing, and you're not feel up to what's expected of you, you instinctively measure how you're doing by comparing yourself against others around you, either in jobs or social situations or whatever. And everybody does it sometimes. I believe people like us have done it a lot. And there's only one thing wrong with those comparisons. The answer you get is always wrong. And the reason it is always wrong is because the comparer never stops to realize at that moment he is comparing his insides against other people's outsides. I am comparing my raw meat against defense mechanisms they've spent 30 years building to conceal their raw meat. So every time you do that, I think it's safe to say you will never see anybody who looks as sensitive as you feel. You will never see anybody who looks as though they have the anxiety you feel. You will never see anybody who seems to be lonely the way you are. I don't mean lonely sitting in a room. I mean the loneliness that chokes you sometimes in the middle of crowds. You will never see anybody who seems to be as resentful against injustice as you are. You'll never see anybody who looks as though they have an empty feeling in their gut that I feel. You can go on and on. But I'll tell you, the more you're insecure, the more you compare to try to feel better without even being aware of it, the further out you put yourself little by little and never even know it. There's one thing everybody in this organization has in common. There may be many things they have in common, but there's one thing I believe that everybody that I've ever seen in AA has in common. By the time they get here, there's one thing they are absolutely certain of, that their case truly is different from the others. And it's, you can laugh about it, but it kills most of them. I've often thought, if I had to design a flag for Alcoholics Anonymous, if I could become the Betsy Ross of AA and design a flag, you know, we could, every other group of troubled people march on Washington, we demand their rights, we could do it too. Except with our leadership, we'll wind up in Seattle saying, now, who do we talk to? You know? But if I had to design a flag for alcoholics, it wouldn't say, I need booze or give me a martini. It would say something much more gut level. It would just, something everyone could gather under. It would just say, but you don't understand. And I'm sure we've all had that feeling. And when you have these emotions and these sensitivities and these feelings, and they seem to be a little more graphic when you are sober, and you drink just to relieve them, how can you really believe that alcohol is your problem? Really. I'm glad that I survived long enough. I'm glad I fell into the hands of people who cared enough for me to weather my dislike of them to save my life. Because I'll tell you, it sounds nice to have people say, I love you however you are, but you may die from it. I want someone to just go on the line and say, do this, whether you like it or whether you like me or not. To learn the most important single fact I have ever learned, and that is this. I want to say this slowly because it may sound strange to you. If my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. Or, to put it a different way, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is an alcohol. Now, that sounds really heretical, doesn't it? But I believe that's absolutely the only way you can come to understand your disease and your recovery. If alcohol is your problem, you hear speakers in AA sometimes say things like, all my life I was just happy except when I drank that damn flit. Then I went crazy. Then I got sober and everything was just wonderful. Then I drank and went crazy with that damn flit. Then I got sober and everything was just wonderful. Then I drank and just went crazy. And you feel like hollering, why do you drink? If I felt good now sober, I wouldn't drink. But it takes a while to understand that if you've got an alcohol problem, you don't even need AA. If you're one of those people tonight whose life is okay except when they drink, I've got a solution for you that's going to revolutionize your future. Don't drink. Just leave your love contributions here on the altar and dance right out down the... But if it turns out that you suffer from what I suffer from, you may go to your grave in 3 weeks or 30 years and never really have ever found out what the hell was wrong. And it isn't alcohol. It's something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking in AA. But it isn't alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. Now you say, what the hell's the difference? A three-letter suffix, what difference does that make? That little difference is what we are here to try to overcome. When you get sober, and you always get sober, sometimes speakers make it sound they stayed drunk for 30 years. That's just a hyperbole. It is impossible to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights under laboratory conditions. That's one of the rotten part about being a drinker. You keep getting sober again. Again. If it weren't for that, AA would have a much smaller membership, I have a feeling. You know, you'd have a different speaker tonight. I might still be the toast of the Chinese palace in downtown Juarez, just standing on the bar and singing my little song. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. It's just that sobering up all the time in the Juarez jail is such a heartache. But you always get sober again and again and again. That's why it isn't much of an incentive. So
if you come to AA, you get sober.
Shit, I've been sober. Yeah. But when you get sober, all you have, if your problem is alcohol, you say, hey man, I'm going to drink any more of that. To hell with it. It's ruined up my life. To hell with it. And that's the end of it. No further therapy is required. No further treatments. You just lead a better life. But in this funny thing called alcoholism, when you get sober, unfortunately for you and me, it looks exactly the same. It looks the same to your family. It looks the same to the police. It looks the same usually to your doctor. It looks the same to your employers or employees. And most deadly, it looks the same to the patient. Does nobody ever seem, because, you know, nobody ever seems to understand, because there's no reason to understand it. You don't slur your words anymore. You don't stumble and fall down. You're supposed to be straight, as straight as you'll ever be. Nobody understands the difference between alcohol problems and alcoholism. Is alcoholism continues on after you're sober. It doesn't stop then. Only you don't, as I say, you don't slur your words. You don't stumble and fall. It takes a different form. It seems to somehow take... It seems to hide in emotions and reactions and sensitivities and feelings and slight distortions of reality and strange interpretations and getting in positions where, why do they all like each other more than they like me? Why are they doing this to me? What does she mean by that? Why am I being screwed? Just on and on and on. And then it starts to get, it just gets to be tedious day after day. The days begin to gray out. I don't mean that you don't see the green and blue and everything, but it's just as though there's a thin layer of Mount St. Helens ash or everything. And nobody's had days like that. Just gray, just... You get to a point where it just stinks. And you're sober. Now, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. There are millions of people who get to that point who are not alcoholics. They are called acute neurotics. They still see reality, but they're unable to cope with it. One thing must be present to be an alcoholic. You must have a body that when you ingest alcohol, it has the effect of altering your perception of reality. It's got to make the same things look different. And you never even think about it. But it doesn't do that for most people. But there isn't a person in this room who hasn't been on the wagon or stopped drinking for a while and finally just give up because it's just so stinking. You take a drink and you can just feel it work its way down. And things start to ease off. And I don't feel much different, but they shape up a little bit. The threats diminish. A man who's... I've sat and thought about some boss that had me scared out of my wits, but after a couple of drinks, I found myself saying, I'm going in and tell that son of a bitch tomorrow what he can do with his job. By the time tomorrow morning comes, I cry, but it changes things. It can take frightened, shy, withdrawn, introverted people, and in 20 minutes can be leaning on a bar with a comfortable smile saying things like, you with anyone, Granny? Yeah. If maybe you've had the experience of what I call Transylvania drinking. They're young till the sunlight hits them. But that alcohol has an effect, and you don't even know it's different from other people. It literally can alter your perspective of reality. And if it can do that, there is no therapy, there is no drug that does it. There is no drug that does it. It just puts you in the world. And if it does that, there's only one wrong thing, one bad thing, kind of. It doesn't do it till you cross that line Sometimes after 30 years of drinking, sometimes the first time you drink. But once it starts to do it, if you ever develop tools to deal with conflict, you don't need them so much anymore, and they begin to atrophy because you're using alcohol to alter situations. If you never had any success in life, you never develop any tools. And eventually, alcohol gets to be a problem. And then you're going to get off it. And then you get into reality and sobriety without ever being aware that your perspectives are wrong, you're seeing the same things everybody else is, and your reactions are out of hand. You wind up kind of. We call them alcoholic emotions. Other people call them ultra-sensitive emotions. There's another term for it that's just sickening, but it's truly valid, I think. You wind up an adult body, an adult brain, an adult ability, adult efforts to abilities to evaluate, justify, explain, adult emotions, adult everything. And all of your life, intermittently at the beck and call of childish emotions, childish petulances, childish hurt feelings, childish feelings of rejection. They're not always there, but they come and go. And the same things eventually make you just get out of whack. And so it turns out, what makes alcoholism deadly is not that you can't get sober. If getting sober was the answer, detoxes would turn out winners. These rehab places would turn out winners. What makes alcoholism deadly is, after you get sober and go back out amongst the stimuli, sooner or later, it just gets to be too goddamn much. And it's kind of funny, except it kills people like you and me. Scientists who study alcoholics say that alcoholics, when they are dry, can get to a point where literally they must drink to preserve their sanity. It gets that bad. This book puts it in a different phrase, but just as true. There seems to be a point at which there is no adequate defense against the first drink. And the reason I mention all that is because I had to learn it, and I suppose some of you might have to learn it if you haven't learned it, that the purpose of AA is not to get sober. The purpose of AA is not to get sober. You can get just as sober in your toilet as you can in AA. You can get just as sober anywhere as you can in AA. The purpose of AA, you may think, is to, if you become good. Not really. There are some bad people staying sober here, and there are some awfully good people drunk on those streets. Maybe it's to develop spiritual superiority. And that's, you know, because sometimes you can find people come to AA, and after 2 years they've learned to pronounce God. After 3 years they think they're God's agent. And they float right off the top. You say, don't you go to meetings anymore? I no longer find them necessary. I walk alone with God. It's hard to argue with those kind of people, I'll tell you. And then one day God gives them a beer, and here they come. I have been flown across the country 2 or 3 times now to talk to a big home in the East where they send alcoholic clergymen from all over the world, so that AAs can give them tips on how to stay sober. Because they can't stay sober, and they are more spiritual drunk than the AAs teach them are sober. Spirituality is necessary, but that in itself is not the answer. The purpose of AA is something that sounds, it's kind of hard to describe because you have nothing to compare it against. The purpose of AA, its steps, to take the steps. They're not to make you good. They're a much better reason than that. Of maybe getting a sponsor that you cannot manipulate when all else fails. The purpose of going to meetings and even hearing things you've heard 1,000 times already and still sit there some more. And the reason becoming involved and committed is not to make you better at all. It's something much more important. I believe that the purpose of AA is exactly the same purpose as I used alcohol for, to alter my perceptions of reality. The purpose of AA in my life has never been to make me better. It's always been to shape the rest of those bastards up. And they know when I don't go to meetings somehow, because they all go to hell again. They know on the freeway when I'm not going to meetings. That guy in the blue car isn't going to meetings. Cut the son of a bitch off. I don't know how they know, but the purpose of doing these things is truly to make the world shape up. Now, I know that it's an intellectual perception on my part, but that's the net effect of it. To this day, I don't know any better rule to apply to yourself. When you're wondering how you're doing, you mustn't look at yourself. Look at the people around you. If they're okay, you're okay. No matter how rotten you might feel at any given moment. If they're all crap heads, you're a crap head. Even if you can prove they are crap heads. And we always make mistakes by examining ourselves. I'm going to check things out and sift them out. You get crazier and crazier. That's why we work with other people. That's why we make amends. So many of AA actions are designed to apparently help other people, but they're not designed to help other people at all. They're designed to break down things in me that keep me looking at the world distorted. I'm glad I came to believe in my sponsor. I'm glad I came to believe in AA. I'm glad I came to believe in God in AA. I swore I never would because I was doomed to hell. But I didn't return to a two-year-old God. I came to believe in a God. And when I go back to Eau Claire and take my parents to church, that same Norwegian God looks infinitely different than he did 50 years ago, 45 years ago. There's only one thing I want to tell you before I sit down, because I think you should be aware of this. That you got to be careful. You don't do this stuff too much, because it can distort your perspective more than you planned. You may get pushed further than you wanted to go, really. As I mentioned, I was 15 years sober. I was back. I was working as a marketing director. And my family was together. Everything was fine. And I kept doing this dumb AA. And it warped me again, a little more than I planned. I found myself leaving a job as a marketing director in Beverly Hills. And for the last 7 years, I have a different job. I am the director of the Midnight Mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Now, you know, that seems kind of a drastic change. Some of my friends say, why in the hell would you want to build yourself back up and then take that cruddy job at the Midnight Mission? And I tried to explain to them. When they threw me out, I told that son of a bitch I'd be back. And now I'm there and he's gone. Just my luck. It is not an alcoholic treatment center. I am not qualified. I'm not an alcoholic counselor. I just run a mission that feeds 250,000 meals a year and beds down 50,000 men. And the only mission of its kind that I know of where there's no religious services. We just try to help people and watch. You know, it's a little different. 7 years ago when I went to work in the morning, a pretty blonde would bring in my coffee and put a sheet of paper in front of me and say how our book sales were doing in Houston and New York and how they were doing in Hamburg, and should I go to Chicago this weekend, and it was kind of nice. And yesterday morning when I went to work, some list on my desk told me who had died in the night, and the problem we were having getting an orderly group into our breakfast, so I went out there to see what was happening, and some fellow didn't like the looks of the back of my head and smashed me alongside the head and knocked my glasses off, and I was glad to see that I hadn't become totally wonderful. I turned around and knocked him down and kicked him before I realized that's
not the AA way.
So at least I helped the son of a bitch up. I can't always control my immediate emotions, but I can control what I do with them. But, you know, it's a funny thing. That isn't very satisfying. See who's dying, who's going to die, what's wrong. But when I go home at night, I have a funny feeling. I have a feeling that I feel more like a man than I ever did going down an elevator in a shiny suit. I don't know why. I feel almost the way as I did in the SS Lewis Pasteur off the Pearl Harbor when alcohol began to work. I feel like I'm home. And I don't think, you know, don't misunderstand me. Even if you go to AA, even if you work the steps, even if you do these things, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. You know. You may have to become rich. I don't know. But I think I can tell you this. You will find yourself in the world looking around and realizing that most of the time something incredible has happened. Your insides are getting better than their outsides. And that cannot be done in any way I know. I am proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's the only therapy I've had since I came here. I'm glad that my family is back. I'm glad my children are here. I'm glad that some people I sponsor came over here tonight to come to this meeting. But most importantly, I am glad when I walk out that door tonight to get in Bill's car, I will not have to look at a street sign. I don't care if it says Main Street out there, or if I'm in Concord or San Francisco or Pleasanton or New York or Chicago or Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I know that if I walk out there doing what I know to do, it'll be a world I can live in and not have to feel bad and drink to stand it. So that's what we have to do. We gather together here to share our experience, strength, and hope on how we can make the world a place that we can be comfortable in most of the time. And when it happens, it's worth everything it took. Thank you.